Welcome to episode 70 of Meenal's World. How are you all doing? Thank you for joining me again this week, and thank you to all of my new listeners from around the world. Your messages really brighten up my day, and I'm so grateful that you're all here with me to learn and to grow. This week, I was joined by Zion Light. Now, she's a British author and activist known for her environmental work and science communication. She's been a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion in the past, and now she's ventured into her own projects. One of the things that really struck me about Zion is that her focus is on educating people on how to live a sustainable life, care for the environment, and still enjoy life. I think one of my biggest issues and concerns were that I'd have to give up everything that I love just to save the planet. But Zion's message is much more than just saving the planet. It's all about creating a lifestyle and trying to find ways to educate people around us and our children and communicate with them as to why this is important and why climate change is something we should all be worried about. And her science communication part as well was very interesting, because the way she puts her message across isn't entirely about scaring people, but it's really focused on educating people. I really enjoyed this conversation, and Zion has a TED Talk which I've also watched, and it's incredible. Her story about why she wanted to work with organizations around climate change is really inspiring, and it's a really touching story. Make sure you do watch it. So without further ado, here's Zion Light. Welcome to the show, Zion. It's so lovely to have you. I know we've taken time to get here, but we're finally here.
Yep, it's good to be here.
How are you doing, Zion? How are things with you? How's the last couple of years been for you during the pandemic?
I'm good, actually. I think I've weathered it really well, especially compared to some of the stories I've heard from people. I have no complaints.
So, Zion, actually, one of the things that I've realized, especially in the last couple of years, people have become more acutely aware of the situations that are affecting us now and that will affect us in generations to come. And one of those things is the climate emergency. Do you feel that energy has become much more powerful now?
Definitely. I mean, I've been talking about climate change for a long time, and thinking back to, you know, even just 5-6 years ago, it was really hard to get people to have a conversation about it. They didn't know anything about it. They didn't take it seriously. And there was also quite a lot of denial. You know, people just saying, I don't think it's real. That's shifted tremendously in just the last few years. So, you know, that's really makes me feel quite optimistic.
Mm. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about those who are denying that the climate crisis is something to worry about. Where do you think that stems from?
Well, we do know that fossil fuel companies spent billions on climate denial. So they funded, you know, groups to go out and kind of talk about fake science, if you like. So I would say that's where it predominantly has come from. And you hear the same arguments against climate change being human driven now that you did years ago. So once those kind of myths are spread, they really can stick with people, and it's really hard to sort of unpick them. Also, I think there is a danger of, you know, some of the groups that are pushing for climate action are being so kind of scary and apocalyptic about it. That's almost creating a backlash with people who then just turn off, and they just say, you're just being overly dramatic, and they're kind of missing the points that, you know, yes, okay, you might not like the way they're communicating it, but it is still a real issue. So there's a lot kind of going on there where it's become a bit polarizing.
Mm. So I think that's one of the things that they've been saying, or they have said about Extinction Rebellion, especially, is that, you know, the way they've portrayed the idea of climate crisis actually making people quite scared. Like, young kids have said, am I going to be alive in the next 10 years? But I also understand that you have to have that sort of urgency as well, right? Because if not, then the message doesn't go out there. And I know that you worked with Extinction Rebellion for some time as well. So what was it like for you at that stage when you're working with a group of people who are so passionate about something, but then also trying to not sort of cross that line of creating that fear in society?
It's always a tricky line to cross, I think, for activists, because you, in a way, as an activist, you can't make your point unless you do something really dramatic. So they close roads, you know, climb onto tubes and trains, and
or stand naked in some banks, right? They've done that as well. Yeah,
all of these actions are designed to get maximum attention. whether or not, I mean, you know.
But then the headline never becomes about the actual climate crisis. That's the thing, right? Because it's the way the media works.
And also, they don't necessarily then communicate very well, even when they are given the opportunity to talk about it, because they'll say things like, we're all going to die. And it's like, well, at least represent, you know, what the science is saying. So I've had an interesting relationship, both working for them and being their spokesperson for a brief period, for about a year, because I saw that they're really passionate people who care about the planet, and that's good, and I agree with that. They are trying to do something about it. They have helped to shift the conversation, that kind of shift we were talking about, where people are now discussing it, and it, you know, it's much more widely accepted that it's real and it's an issue. That's come from groups like Extinction Rebellion and a lot of the work they've done. But I think, yeah, there's a danger now of just keep like continuing to scare people, continuing to pull stunts, and also just kind of annoying lots of people, which makes it more polarizing again, because people might agree with the issue, but they don't want to agree with the group or the individuals. But it's always hard in activism, because, you know, essentially that's what activism is. It's get lots of attention, be loud, be annoying. And it has paid off for some social movements over the course of history in many, you know, many countries in many different ways. And you can't predict the outcomes of that. So they almost just think, if our motivations are good enough, we just do it and we'll just see what happens. And we're yet to see what happens, actually. I think, you know, a lot of governments now have made really good pledges on climate action. We really moved very quickly in the last few years. Is it enough? I would say this, you know, there's always more work that can be done, but I can see the shifts are happening. And I don't think that those groups and Extinction Rebellion really recognize that, which is a shame. Because I think you also need to sort of know what you stand for as well as what you stand against.
What is it that you stand for?
Well, I believe that everybody should have the right to live in a habitable planet. By that, I don't just mean a planet that's being changed with climate change. I mean with clean air. You know, air pollution is a huge issue. With abundant energy. You know, I don't think it's fair that people live in energy poverty, and that's even happening now. With rising energy costs. You know, I think that all of those needs should be met, but just in a way that is healthy for people and planet and all the life on the planet. Whereas, you know, traditionally we've kind of developed and got everything that we need to have a good lifestyle by accidentally harming the planet. When I say accidentally, that is, you know, through things like burning fossil fuels, which we initially didn't know were going to be so harmful, just like CFCs. You know, we used to use those, didn't we? We found out they were harmful to the ozone layer. We banned them, ozone repaired. To me, it's the same with climate change. We know now what the damage is. We know what the solutions are, and we should aim for that. And this is where I differ from groups like Extinction Rebellion, where they're saying we should give up a lot of the good things we have. We should give it all up because we did damage. And I don't actually think that's, well, first of all, I don't think it would happen anyway, right? Like most of us are trying to kind of live with less and do less. It's not that easy. And actually it favors wealthy people, because if you're wealthy, you can have solar panels on your roof, you can have an electric vehicle, and you can get heat pumps and all of those things which aren't accessible to most people. And again, so we should argue for those, but these groups aren't arguing for those. They aren't fighting for, you know, that you know, everybody to be given a free heat pump and EV, you know. So that's where we kind of differ. And it's quite unusual for someone like me who's been in the environmental movement for a long time to actually say, no, but growth is okay, but let's just make it sustainable and clean. And just remember that people are at the heart of this, and we don't want people to suffer through climate change just because, you know, we messed up essentially.
I think there has to be a more holistic approach to how we can all play a small part in, you know, healing the planet. And as you said, I think that it's important to understand that it isn't just about stopping it and just cutting the bandage off. It's impossible. It's not feasible. And it kind of puts people off that way as well, you know, by saying this is what you have to do. And I think as a doctor as well, and in medicine, we learn so much about communication and how you try to get to the root of the problem and how to heal people. And I think that's kind of the same when it comes to the climate crisis as well. I'm not an expert on it in no sense at all compared to yourself and those at Extinction Rebellion. But I think communication, especially in this day and age with social media being such an important pivotal role in decision making, that has to be at the heart of everything.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that's where sometimes the mistakes happen, is that the actions might be to get attention, but when it gets to the communication aspect, it's not always it's not always that clear. So you still hear people saying, well, I really care about this issue, but what can I actually do? If I don't want to go and sit in a road or strip naked in a bank, what can I actually do? And those people need options. And the truth is that for decades, the environmental movement has been saying that the option is to live with less. And so I'm trying to say, actually, that hasn't worked. And most of us do live with less. I don't leave all my lights on when I'm not in the room. You know, most people do try, but that's not going to make very much of a difference. If we're honest, we just look at basic math, how much energy is that saving? You know, it's nothing. So actually, we need to look instead at getting energy from clean sources, like renewables, nuclear energy, carbon capture storage, which I know a lot of environmentalists don't like, but that is what climate scientists say we're going to need, you know. And all of the solutions, some of them are technological, some of them are not. Some of them are like insulating houses. That's a common sense thing to do. And again, a lot of councils are doing that. So, you know, a lot is being done. There's an argument for it to be done quicker. Sure, that's always going to be the case. But I think also we need to be careful of sort of saying, because a lot of people do feel this now. You said it earlier about, you know, children worrying that they're not going to have good lives and live out their lives and things like that. Actually, if they feel like there's too much doom and gloom, they just don't feel like doing anything at all. So we need to sort of come back from that narrative and say, actually, even if the truth is that even if the planet keeps warming and it gets bad, it will be like a slow incremental thing. Like I appreciate that for people in certain countries like the global south, it's going to be worse and they're going to feel the effects worse. You know, like a heat wave over there is much more deadly than over here, things like that. But at the same time, there's no point at which it's too late to take action to stop that global warming. There's no point. So even if we've missed targets now, that doesn't mean it's too late and we give up. Because you hear a lot of this dialogue, like it's too late, you know. But no, it's never, ever too late. You will still save lives and hopefully the planet if you act right now, even if, yeah, there's going to still be some residual warming for a while because we're kind of locked into some of that now because of everything we pumped into the atmosphere. But that message isn't getting through. You know, that message should be in the communication, but it's far easier to say, we're all going to die. And actually, it's really counterproductive. And it does take you away from, you know, like you said, you end up talking about the action rather than this point I'm making, which is not a simple point that you can just make, you know, that you can just put on a placard. It's never too late to stop, to take action against global warming. Maybe it should be on a placard.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Yeah, I think that now with communication, especially, people want it in like a very digestible form. It's not what it used to be like 2-3 years ago. As you said, it has to be, if you can write it on a placard, then you got your message across. And that's a really good point that you've made, that everything on social media happens to be that way now, unfortunately.
Yeah, even newspapers now have got quite, the titles can be quite clickbaity.
Yeah, it's not news anymore, and it's not serving its purpose as it used to, I'd say. But Zion, why is it that you went into Extinction Rebellion in the first place? And just talk me through your time there and why you felt like maybe that wasn't the right place for you.
Initially, I got in touch with the local group because I saw they were doing a lot of actions. They actually did a road closure that affected me because I was waiting for a bus. And I thought, who are these people? I'll go and see. You know, and the bus didn't turn up because they'd blocked the road. I thought, I'll go and see who they are, and sort of started talking to them, and then I got quickly sort of sucked into the overall kind of core organizing group, which is the group that founded Extinction Rebellion, which had a London headquarters, but it was people based all over the UK. And they said, one of the founders said, I've seen your TED talk on stargazing, you're really good at communicating things, will you come and do this for us? And, you know, at that point they were new, they'd just done the April Rebellion where they shut 5 sites across London. One of them was Waterloo Bridge movement, you know, Dedrick Knob. I thought, there's lots of press here, and if I'm not one of the people speaking to the press, then what are the other activists going to be saying? You know, you don't have any training in communicating, maybe don't understand the science. So I agreed to do it, you know, initially, and I did have some good slots through Extinction Rebellion where I got to speak to journalists and you know, a few TV slots. But the turning point for me came when the group, I think the group kind of lost its way, and one of the founders made a comment on live television that 6 billion people were going to die by the end of the century, and it was just made up, right? I mean, everyone knew it was made up, but that happened. It was all over the news, and I was asked to comment on it, and I kind of went back to this group and I said, you know, I'm not defending a figure that was made up. He's admitted it was a back of the envelope calculation. You know, that's not how science works. There's already lots of terrible things that climate change is causing right now. Now everybody's just talking about 6 billion people, you know, and then they're saying, well, that's not going to happen. So none of it's true. So I said, actually, it's damaging the cause and we should retract it. And this went on for about 6 weeks of debating, because kind of half the group didn't want to retract it because they said, who cares what the numbers are? People will die. And half the group said, no, we need to be accurate. We can't lie. We lose credibility. And a decision wasn't really made. It just, now they kind of have backed that figure. But at the time they were like, it doesn't matter. Everybody's forgotten about it. And then I got asked to go on the Andrew Neil show. And, you know, it's fine. I had all my facts in my head. I was ready to debate with him. I watched his show. I'm aware of what he's like. I sat down and he asked me about that figure. And he said, well, do you stand behind this figure that your organization has come out with? And I mean, I couldn't agree with it because I knew it was made up, and I couldn't disagree with it because I was there as a spokesperson. And I realized that, like, in that moment with, you know, millions of people watching, I realized, actually, I can't do this anymore. It's as far as I can take it for this group. I've done as much communication as I could, but it would be better for me to do it just as myself and not as a spokesperson for any group anymore. So I left and then founded my own group called Emergency Reactor. It's, you know, similar principles in wanting to fight climate change, but looking at solutions rather than just what we hate. And also, yeah, with a focus on some, you know, optimism. I mean, look, we don't get huge news coverage because we don't close down roads and, you know, and any of that stuff. And so it's hard to get the conversations out there. But I have found that people are so receptive because they're so bored of hearing the same, you know, doom and gloom that we've heard for decades. And it just makes them, that kind of approach just makes them want to give up. And I really think that the environmental movement needs to learn from, you know, I mean, they've been saying the same thing since the 70s, live with less, live on the land. Like, that's not going to happen. People don't want that. People want more tech. People want more energy. We just have to make sure that it comes from clean sources and it's not harming the planet. That's it.
Well, that's the thing, right? I think with the climate crisis, you have to think about your messaging in a way that's sort of idiot proof, right? Like, I want to be able to tell my dad about it so he understands it, or tell my grandparents about it so they understand it, and make it a more welcoming conversation. I mean, I don't know what Extinction Rebellion have been doing in the last few years. Obviously, I'm just asking from your point of view and your perspective. And I don't know what the communications is like now, and I don't know what the strategy is. But I do think everything that you do, whether it's for whatever cause it is, but climate crisis especially, because you've got so many different generations involved, it has to be approachable, you know? But I know that you've been advocating quite a lot for nuclear power as well. And it was something that I've never thought about, that if you're creating these renewable energy resources like solar power, windmills, there is eventually going to be waste from that as well. And I never thought about that. Like, and it's so obvious as well when I say it out loud, because we live in Gibraltar. So when we drive down the coast of Spain, we see the windmills all the time. And for us, it's like, wow, this is great. You know, a large part of the southern Spanish population is using renewable energy resources. But just to explain to me, obviously, and to my listeners as well, what are the main, like, differences between nuclear power movement and focusing on renewable energy resources?
Basically, we need both. So the problem is that actually that people keep arguing, should we have nuclear or renewables? But the argument should be, how do we stop fossil fuels? We are so dependent on fossil fuels. There's only a few countries that have decarbonized and don't need to use fossil fuels anymore. And they have done it with a combination of nuclear and renewables. That's it. So you get a lot of people arguing, we only need renewables. And that could be great in theory, but that's an experiment that hasn't worked anywhere. The only place where there's a huge amount of renewables that works is when the country has a lot of hydropower. You know, if you have dams, that's a whole other thing. But also, renewables is a bit of a weird term. I don't really like that term because it includes biomass, which is actually really bad for the environment. It's basically burning wood, like burning wood pellets. It's not sustainable. It's not carbon neutral. And then you get nuclear energy. A lot of people have a really strong emotional response to nuclear energy. And I get it because I used to be one of those people. I was in these kind of groups for a long time, you know, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and they would tell you, you know, it's evil and it kills loads of people and it's wrong. And it was only when I started looking into the science and I went, you know, I did a master's that focused on kind of deciphering data and communicating it to people, that I started realizing that I was completely wrong about everything I thought about nuclear. And as you say, you know, everything creates waste, and actually the waste is really well managed. And, you know, this, the international consensus is that you should just bury it. I mean, essentially they take uranium out of the earth anyway. It's already radioactive. They use it up. It's not as strong anymore. You just bury it. Like, yeah, it leaves some chemicals behind, but so do wind turbines and solar power. In fact, solar panels leave behind hazardous waste. It is classed as hazardous waste, and it's not recycled. It's left in landfill sites. So it's interesting to me that all the focus has been on regulating nuclear. And I almost think this kind of arguing about one or the other has just, you know, got fossil fuel companies sitting in the corner going, haha, look at them. We're just making more money than ever. You know, and we're never going to wean off them. And I think actually that is the hardest fight, because these corporations are so wealthy and so powerful. And we haven't managed, right? We haven't managed to wean off them. And Britain's heavily dependent still on mostly imported gas, coal as well, which I think is disgusting. We would never, ever allow a coal power station here because it's so polluting. It's so harmful to the people that live there, you know. Compared with nuclear, you know, you're completely safe to live near a nuclear power station, but you live near a coal fire power station and you catch the kind of wind, you are exposed to all kinds of chemicals from that. And, you know, children growing up in those areas have respiratory issues and they have higher rates of cancer. It's terrible. You hear about these cases and you think, we don't mind when that's abroad in a poor country where people are stuck having to live there so that we can meet our energy needs. I just think that's disgusting and we have to stop doing it. And we should build whatever we need, you know, wind turbines, solar power, nuclear energy. And the reason that I would say they need to go together is because if you have wind and solar power when it isn't windy and sunny, you need a backup. And at the moment, that is fossil fuels. Like, that's why we're importing coal. It would be better if that was nuclear. So the reason I've been communicating about it a lot is because, there's a lot of misinformation about nuclear, even and about renewables, because people just think, I've heard people say renewables are free. It's just the wind and the sun. Well, no, there's a lot of mining involved. There's a lot of resources, you know, be honest about it. And then, you know, solar panels, turbines will last 25 to 30 years. They have to be replaced. A nuclear power station will last 50, 60 years longer. And we've got one in the UK that's approaching that now, that age. So it's kind of like, if you're going to use the resources as well, then choose something that is the least impactful on the environment. You know, don't just let your ideology get in the way. But the main thing I always point to is the IPCC report, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is the reason we know that climate change is serious, right? These reports, that they have huge scientific consensus, 99% consensus. They are composed of hundreds of scientists, top experts in their fields contribute to these reports, and then they write the conclusions. So groups like Extinction Rebellion focus on that first chapter of the report, which is about, here's the problem. But there's another section, same report, which is by Working Group 3, and it's about mitigation. And in there, it has, you know, ways to decarbonize. So it's like the solution section. No one ever talks about it. They just talk about the problem. Same research, same scientists. And that bit says, to decarbonize, we need renewables and nuclear. So that's enough for me. So when people say, why are you advocating for this? I say, because everybody knows about renewables. Nobody knows about nuclear. And therefore it's not going to change, because actually you even get some of the people, not all of them, but some of the people in the green groups who are against nuclear. But all you're doing really is you're saying, I'd prefer fossil fuels. And I've even heard people admit that, you know, Germany's done that with, you know, they phased out the nuclear power plants and they signed up to the Nord Stream pipeline with Russia, and they're very, very heavily dependent on Russian fossil fuels in Germany.
So why are some campaign groups against nuclear if they're campaigning for a cleaner world and they want to reduce the risk of climate crisis and climate change? What's the reasoning behind that?
It's just an irrational fear. It's like asking, why are people scared of vaccines? You know, I could give you 50 reasons, but are they any of those the real reasons? You know, they're worried about mercury, they're worried about autism, they're worried about all these made up things. And it's really just somehow an irrational fear has got in, you know, got in there. And that is so hard to unpick. So I had that fear about nuclear because I was surrounded by people that had that fear. I then kind of use logic to overturn that, but it's very hard to change your beliefs. And I even had some friends, you know, who weren't very nice to me about it when I did change my mind. It's a very sort of threatening thing to them, because it's like, that's their ideology. And that's what I've been trying to shift. And I think I have helped to shift it because of my background, because I've been so active in these movements for so long. And it's slow. I think it is slowly changing, but I actually have written recently about how fossil fuel companies have really worked hard to mislead people about nuclear energy. Because if you're a fossil fuel company CEO, and you see that there's a product that can displace you, it's a really good idea actually to get people to be afraid of that product. And that's not, you know, that this, I know it sounds a little bit conspiratorial, but I actually have found articles and things where they have linked things like anti-nuclear campaigns in the US, for example, that were funded by fossil fuel companies. Like this is just available to read online. These are not, they're from news sites, that it's not conspiratorial. When I came across them, I was like, that actually makes a lot of sense, but it's funny that nobody knows, but it makes complete sense. And once that fear and like, you know, for example, the way that what happened in Fukushima really scared people, right? Even though nobody died from the meltdown, lots of people died from the tsunami and the earthquake. Yes, there was a power plant meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, but that didn't harm anybody. Like, you know, people don't realize that. And I didn't realize that. I thought like hundreds of thousands of people died because that's what I was told. And then when I realized that wasn't true, I realized, hang on a minute, hundreds of thousands of people die from fossil fuels. Air pollution alone from fossil fuels kills over 8 million people a year. And they're always from the poorest, most marginalized communities because they have to live near the coal-fired power stations. They have to live in the regions with poor air pollution, the poorest air pollution, right? Like, it's just so unfair. And that's why I realized, like, you can't talk about that without talking about what will replace those things. It has to be nuclear energy. And so a lot of it for me has been about the communication, getting people to shift their mindsets on it, because it's so important. And if we don't do it now, they do take time to build. You know, we need to build them now, and rather than in 20 years say, oh, if we just built a load of those, we'd be fine. Yeah, we can build all the solar and wind we like, but we need a backup as well for when it isn't windy or solar, especially in this country. It's not, you know, it's not often sunny enough. So it depends a little bit on the region too. You know, some places will get more sun, but there's still a problem of storage, that you can't just store it indefinitely. Whereas, you know, with nuclear, we call it baseload power. With nuclear, all fossil fuels are also baseload, which is that they can always just provide, you know, a steady amount of energy.
Zian, do you think that a lot of these climate groups are sort of, you're in some sort of echo chamber? Because it does seem like, as you mentioned, that people are trying to advocate for renewable energy, but they're also afraid of nuclear power. When you're working with these people, I mean, they're not extremist views in any sense, but what I'm trying to say is that they're very passionate about what they actually want as the end goal, that it's so difficult to sort of think outside the box because you're so laser focused on what you want. So do you think to some extent joining these climate change groups can be a bit dangerous, or should you go in with an open mind?
That's a really good question. I mean, my perspective is that these groups, you know, the people really care and they want solutions. But you can care about a cause and then not understand the science and accidentally do damage when you're talking about solutions, right? So this solution of everybody should live with less and convert all of their house to be, you know, as net zero and all of that, that's a very privileged position. That's a very middle class view. And Extinction Rebellion is predominantly very middle class. And, you know, I'm not saying there isn't diversity there. There is some, and they do try to encourage it, but their views are very middle class. Nah. Therefore, then they say, I wonder why we don't have more people from other groups joining us. Well, those views don't appeal to other people who are just trying to put food on the table. You know, and you're saying risk arrest or risk, you know, use less energy. Like, I used to be a member of the Green Party, and it was the same thing. They're just such middle-class views. It's okay for so-and-so with their allotment and, you know, their nice retirement and all of these things to live a low-carbon lifestyle. But for most of us, it's really hard. So I initially started out with exactly the same arguments that they all have in those movements, which was, you know, I had a book published, which was about how to raise children with a low-carbon footprint. It was evidence-based. It was very much that opinion, like, how do we live with less? How do we get people to do this? But first of all, obviously, that hasn't made a difference. Like, we actually just use more energy than ever before. The only time that's ever changed was during lockdown because people were forced to stay at home. So unless you're saying that we should all be forced all the time, like, it's just not going to happen. We've done every kind of encouragement for, you know, turn off your lights and drive less. And people are doing that. But it's just so insignificant with how much we need to bring down emissions. So there's something wrong there anyway. But also, I have spoken to some of the people in these groups, and I've argued with them when I was a member, when I'd say, look, you're kind of fetishizing poverty because you're saying we should all live on the land and look at these communities are so happy in these rural areas. And that's why I ended up voicing a different opinion, because I actually am from a different background. I'm from a very working class background. I have immigrant parents, you know, and I realized, hang on a minute, they're idolizing something that my parents, you know, got in a boat to escape, leaving behind all their families so that their kids could have something better, so they could have a better quality of life. And now you're saying we should all give up the high quality of life. And it's actually the leader of the Green Party that was on a discussion with her. It's recorded online, you know. She said, Zion, we don't have a high quality of life. Look at the mental health issues. Now, I agree we have issues, but we are not rice farmers in rural India praying that it rains so we have enough food to eat, right? We're not worried about infant mortality rates. We're not worried that someone's going to get bit by a snake and they're going to die, not because there isn't anti-venom in existence, but because they don't have access to it. They don't have the infrastructure to get the access to it. You know, all of these things we once upon a time didn't have here, we developed and now we have them. And these groups are basically saying, well, we kind of made some mistakes, so we should go back. And it is so rude, frankly. You know, those people are desperate not to live in poverty. And you're saying, they're happier, and they're not happier. Like, they might be happier in a way, they have that kind of community, but they're just surviving, right? They're not thriving. They if you offer them the chance to escape the country, I mean, my parents didn't know where Britain was on a map. They were offered jobs here, and they just got on the boat. That was it. They were just like, why would you want to raise your kids in poverty? And they always miss their family over there. They always miss the community, but they can't go back now. You know, they've been to visit, and they're used to a high quality of life now. That is what all people want. They want their children not to be sick. They want them to have decent jobs. They want them to have clean air to breathe. These are good things, you know, and that's I think, the core of where those movements have gone wrong. And actually, I would say don't join a movement that believes that, because it's not about going in and trying to change it. I have tried. I have made these arguments, and they don't care. They don't care about poverty, and they don't care about people suffering. And there's even a little bit of, wow, people have made the planet suffer, so we're going to suffer. I don't buy into that. I don't think that's right. I care about the climate because I care about life on the planet, and that includes people.
Wow. I never thought about it that way at all, Zion. I didn't realize that it's there's so much of a disbalance and distance between the reality and what they're actually trying to achieve. And I think you're very right. I remember when I spent my gap year in Swansea, and I worked on some farm, which was all about renewable energy resources and sort of recycling water and creating a sort of system where there was as little waste as possible. And I remember I tried to be happy in that environment and like try to just feel like this was the right thing, but I hated it. I really hated it, Zion, because you know, you go from a world where you're going into school every day and you're on your computer and you're socializing, just be put literally in the middle of a farm. And I was like, is this what it means to actually care for the environment? Because I'm not enjoying it and I don't like it. And now that you've made me reflect on it, I've realized that there are ways where I can still be part of the, you know, climate change movement and still, you know, enjoy my life. It doesn't have to be, not everything has to be a sacrifice.
Exactly. Well, I think you've hit on something there, which is almost like a religious belief in the environmental movement that if you're not sacrificing, you're not doing enough. And it's that what I'm saying is completely like mind blowing to those people, because I'm saying you shouldn't have to sacrifice. You shouldn't have to. We should all have decent lives. We should all not be in poverty, have enough food to eat, have abundant energy, but also let's save the planet. It's entirely possible.
Susanna, what I wanted to ask you was that you are very passionate about the way you speak about climate change. And like I can see, you know your stuff, you know what you're talking about, and you know how to tap into people's brains and understand how to communicate, which is quite incredible, actually, because very few people like that who are creating movements, who are activists and campaigners, who have that skill. Is this something that you were always good at? Like as a young child, is this something that you always aspired to be? Because when I listened to your TED talk and you talked about looking at the stars, I just wonder, was it just that moment itself, or did you have an experience before that?
I think I was always like that, because when I was little, I was a prolific writer. I was always writing into newspapers. I had poems published. I did not come from that kind of background where, you know, there was high science literacy or there was a lot of literature around. We didn't have books at home. We were a very poor family. But I just, for some reason, was that kid that was always trying to communicate and always trying to kind of help and writing about issues that I cared about. And, you know, I even won some awards when I was a kid. And I think my parents were just kind of like, what is she doing? You know, she's the quirky one. But I was always trying to communicate, and I was always trying to make the world a better place. So I was always going to end up doing that. But I definitely have been on a real journey, because the groups that I went into, because I thought, I care about the environment, that's what I should do. Just like you, right? Going on the farm and then going, something not right here. Or even if I do like it, is everybody going to like it? You know, just kind of thinking, how do I actually speak to other people? Then I, you know, then I actually studied science communication, because I realized that's actually a really, really important skill. So I was always going to end up doing it, I think, and it is what I'm passionate about. But also, I just love people. I think people are great. You know, look, I know that's not what most people think, and they're like, oh, you're just optimistic. I think it's easy to be pessimistic. I think it's easy to think that people are all bad. Look at the amazing things that we have done. Look at the amazing vaccines that we have created to enable people to have healthy lives. Look at all of the things that people fight for every day, all of the causes. Yes, there are also people that fight against, right? Just like, I mean, you know, look at what's happening in Russia. You'll always get somebody who does something like that. But the whole world has risen up to that challenge. We don't always get it right, you know, but I actually talk about space science a lot, because I think it shows where we thrive when we collaborate, you know, when we collaborate, when we create things that we send up into space and the astronauts work together, we realize we're just one people, really. I know that sounds a bit hippie-ish, but we really are. There's no differences here. This is it. This is one planet, the one known habitable planet in the universe. And we survive here together, and that's it. And that's it. And I think actually everybody knows that deep down, but we just get bogged down, don't we, with all of everything else. And we have such a short time in the world. I mean, I'm just here to try and make things better. I'm happy doing that. That makes me happy, you know. But everybody's looking for meaning, and everybody's looking for reasons to be happy. And I always just say, you know, there's space for everybody in the environmental movement. There's space for everybody in every movement. There's no end to the amount of things that you can help with, that you can achieve. And if we work together, we really are a phenomenal species. I mean, we have created space probes that we have sent outside our own solar system. It's incredible what we can achieve. We have created an international space station where, you know, we constructed a station in space that orbits the planet. It gives us lots of data. And, you know, you can see these incredible pictures of our planet, and you just think, well, that's worth saving, isn't it? And isn't that amazing that we managed to do that? That collaboration took 16 countries. So I always say this to people about climate change. If we really want to, we can work together and we can fix things. But also, I'm optimistic, because I do think there's been a lot of movement forward in the last few years. Yes, you can say that it's taken too long, or whatever, you know, whatever negative thing people want to say. But that doesn't change the fact that it's happening now, and that it's never too late to take action. And the fact that it's happening now really is a hopeful thing that we should celebrate.
Wow. That's really amazing, Ziana, that you put it that way. You're very right. I think there are enough of us in this world to put our forces together and create something positive. Whereabouts were you born and raised, Ziana?
I was born and raised in the Midlands.
Did you spend much time going back to India to see family and stuff? Or?
So I went when I was a kid, but I don't really remember that. And then I went when I was a teenager, which was a huge wake-up call for me, like seeing the poverty firsthand. Obviously, I'd heard my parents talk about it, but it's something else seeing it, you know, and just hundreds of cousins there who are like... Yeah, hundreds, quite like, because my mum's village, my dad's village, so many people. Yeah. But, you know, just looking at them and their humble lives and just thinking, wow, am I lucky or what that I was not born there? Like, the opportunities that I have had, I'm grateful for every single day. And I wish that they could have them. And it's not even just about they want clean water, they want enough food, they want laptops, they want phones. Who are we to say that they don't get to have those? I don't think so, you know? Mm-hmm. So I really try to be a voice for those people, because they don't have a voice. Yeah. No one's going to listen to what they have to say. And they are the people that are going to be most impacted by climate change.
Yeah. And that's the thing, Ziana. I mean, you talk about renewable energy and nuclear energy. And these are only things, like, I guess we can talk about when we are raised in a country when we're quite privileged. I mean, you wouldn't hear kids in less developed countries in different parts of the world talking about the climate crisis because they need to put food on their table. You know, it's not on their priority list. So when you're trying to educate people about climate change and trying to create a system that's more equitable to different parts of the world, do you think that's possible to achieve with a combination of renewable energy sort of resources and nuclear power?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, some countries have managed it. If you look at France, France built lots of nuclear power stations back in the 80s. They built like 56 reactors or something. Never had a problem, never had a meltdown. Lots of clean jobs. You know, they're good jobs as well because they offer, you know, engineering apprenticeships. Like people really covet jobs in that industry. And then they had, once those were built, they took about 10 years to build them. Then ever since they've been carbon, like decarbonized, not carbon neutral, but low carbon output. So they're one of the cleanest countries in the world. So the energy mix is really clean. Yeah, a lot of people don't realize. If you look at the energy mix, they do have wind and solar too. They've built that too. That's great. And they're building more because everybody's using more energy, and we always will, right? We'll always have more appliances, more tech that use more energy. It's very hard to use less, very hard, unless you just give everything up and go and live on the land, which no one wants to do, which I understand. And there are other countries that have managed it, like Norway and Sweden. But, you know, Norway has a lot of hydropower, so it's exceptional. Like a lot of places don't have that. Sweden has a lot of nuclear and hydro, so they've managed to do it like that. But nowhere has managed to do it without. So that's really the takeaway. You know, if those countries did it decades ago, we could do that now. Why hasn't every, I really think every country that has, you know, the wealth to be able to do it should be doing it right now. Just, and actually we're not doing too badly in Britain, much as I'm not a fan of the government. They are building quite a lot of renewables and nuclear finally, and that is going to help a lot. But they've dithered for like 12 years. They should have built this stuff 12 years ago. It would be running now. We would have clean energy, and we wouldn't be worrying about our emissions and worrying every time you switch on the light, you know?
Why didn't they do this 12 years ago? I mean, what was...
Your guess is as good as mine. I think people are just really not connected. I think politicians are not connected with what's happening in the world. I mean, look at Germany being so reliant on Russia for coal, gas and oil that they've said they can't, because there's a lot of pressure now in Germany to shut all of that off. And they've literally said, if we do that, our own people are going to be harmed because we'll have blackouts, you know, we won't have resources. And I understand that, but come on, they didn't see that coming. They didn't look us sideways at Russia and think maybe we shouldn't be really dependent on them, you know? And they shut their own nuclear power stations. They had lots. They had like 12 or something. They shut them. So they put people out of jobs, clean energy workers out of jobs because they just didn't want it anymore. Yeah, they didn't want it anymore. Now there's a lot of pressure for them to reopen them, but they're still saying they don't want to reopen them. And you just think, I don't know, I guess a lot of politicians don't have good science literacy and they fall for ideology instead. And that's a very dangerous thing, actually. It's good that more and more are coming around now, but these things could have been implemented years ago. We have the solutions right here. That's really good. That's really positive. But we definitely need more people talking about it. And certainly the activists don't seem to.
Yeah. Well, Zion, what does your work directly revolve around now? Because you've got your own group that you're trying to campaign for and trying to educate people and encourage people that the climate crisis isn't as scary and we can all play a part in it. So what exactly does your group do, and you know, what impact has it had in the last couple of years?
We do actions. So we've been down to London and dropped banners, and it's just public engagement, really. We also had stalls in London and Bristol where we handed out hundreds of bananas. There was one day where we handed out 500 bananas. So each banana is a conversation, basically, because the person says, why are you handing me a banana? Well, do you know they're naturally radioactive? And it's really interesting to have that conversation. What do you mean? Isn't that bad? Well, actually, everything's kind of radioactive, including people. You know, it's only bad if it's at a certain level. And then you can have a really good discussion about what their fears are around nuclear energy, what they know about renewables and nuclear. And I never met a single person, and I had so many conversations, I've never met a single person who said, yeah, we should have fossil fuels. They're all like, we don't want fossil fuels, but they don't know what the solutions are.
Yeah.
So once they understand that, and I always say, go and have a look yourself. You know, you don't have to trust me. Have a look at the IPCC data, listen to some of what these climate scientists are saying. Then they feel really hopeful and they're like, I didn't realize that was really good. So we're really just doing public engagement and trying to, you know, fill the gaps that we've been talking about that those movements aren't doing. And we don't kind of do it in a disruptive way. We're very friendly, very approachable, you know, and we just have conversations, a team of about 12 of us, just all day sat in the park with bananas and stalls and leaflets, you know, and just, I mean, sometimes someone dresses up as a banana as well. And it's quite fun, you know, it's the opposite. It's quite fun. And it's just having conversations. And I actually think that in itself is so powerful and has led, you know, it hasn't had the impact Extinction Rebellion's had. But as you said, often it then becomes more about their action than what they're saying. For us, it's more about what we're saying than anything else. So that has led to some journalists going away and looking into it and writing about it. And that shift has been happening over the past kind of year. So yeah, I'm proud of that. You know, in our small way, we are making that difference. And the fact that we have all these volunteers shows there's a space for everybody in these movements. It's just maybe, you know, those people wanted to be part of a group and they didn't feel that they fit into the other groups. They didn't want to go and stay on a farm, you know, and now they're like, oh, I do want to stand and talk to people about science in the sunshine with bananas. Mm. And it's amazing, actually. It's amazing. There's one volunteer called Louis who he speaks Danish and French and English. And when we were at a stall in London, I saw him speaking to someone in French who couldn't speak, you know, good enough English to understand all the kind of technicalities that he was explaining about nuclear energy. And then I heard him later talking in Danish. I was like, you guys are amazing. This is, you know, communication is everything. And actually sometimes if you do the wrong action, you shut down the communication because you've upset people straight away and you've lost them. So I'm really happy that we're building those bridges instead. Very occasionally you get a kind of shouty person saying, you know, something negative. But even then we just have a conversation. It's hard to shout at someone when they're just handing you a banana, you know, and just smiling.
Yeah, because banana isn't a very strong weapon, so you will feel sorry for them at some point. But Zion, I think, you know, after listening to your story, I think firstly, I just wanted to say that it's quite brave to say to a group like Extinction Rebellion or whatever groups you've worked with, even with the Green Party, and say, actually, you know, this doesn't align with my ethos and this doesn't align with my values. And no matter how far you could have got with them financially or popularity-wise, you decided to take a step back and start your own thing. And I think that really, you know, just is a big statement to who you are, Zion. So I just wanted to say thank you for sharing your story, because that bravery, I'm sure, would be an inspiration to lots of listeners today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It's been really good.
Yeah, Zion. And if there's anybody who wants to get in touch with you directly or actually be part of your movement, what's the best way to do that?
We have a website. It's emergencyreactor.org. And there's a contact form on there, but also there is a mailing list. And if you sign up to that, we send out, you know, information about events we're doing or anytime we're in the press or anything like that. But mainly just, you know, I'm very active on Twitter at Zeontree. Just get in touch with me and try and put you in touch with people. But we will be doing more events now that the weather's getting better. We'll be doing more in big cities around the UK. So just, you know, find out when they are and come along. We're super friendly and you get to eat free bananas.
That's great. See, and I'll leave everything in the show notes below. And I'm definitely going to share your stuff when you start doing all these campaigns. But thank you so much, Zion. I really appreciate your time today. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week. And a huge, huge thank you to Zion and all my other guests who join me every week to share their journeys, to share their ideas. Everything helps us learn, and I hope it helps all of you listeners to learn and to grow as well. I've shared all the links to Zion's social media in the show notes below. I've also left the link to her TED Talk as well. And as I said, you should really, really watch that. It's a beautiful story. You can also follow me on social media at Dr. Meenal Viz, and you can get in touch with me via my website, meenalviz.com. I love to hear from you, and I love to hear about the ideas that you have. And some of you even give me ideas as to which guests I can bring on, which I love as well. I hope you're all in good health, and I hope you're all well. And a big, big hug to you all for joining me. And thank you so much for all of your support. I'll see you again next Friday. And until then, have a lovely week.